The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 332, Kingdom in the West, an Editor's Roundtable. The panelists are Will Bagley, Michael Homer, Violet Kimball, B. Carmen Hardy, Melvin C. Johnson, William McKinnon, and Lydia Carter.
I think I've got it. It's Clark Company. Kingdom in the West, Mormons in the American Frontier. I've passed out a current series list, and as we note at the very start, it's a work in progress. We have several other proposals for volumes. We're close to sure that many of these titles will change, but I'm happy to announce that the series is off to an excellent beginning. In 1997, to commemorate the sesquicentennial of the Mormon Pioneer Company, the Clark Company published The Pioneer Camp of the Saints, which is Thomas Bullock's 1846-47 journals and includes the official journal of the Brigham Young Pioneer Company. The series actually began when I submitted the Bullock manuscript to the Clark Company in 1995, and I had been a fan of the Arthur H. Clark Company since I was a kid. And I had always had an ambition as a Western historian to have a Clark imprint. And I was greatly honored. I was delighted that Bob expressed interest in the manuscript and accepted it. But I was flabbergasted when he suggested to me that I might edit a documentary historical series for the Clark Company. Of course, the Clark Company has published some of the great epics of the West in a continuing set of series that include Leroy Hafen's The Far West in the Rockies and Ralph Bieber's documentary history on the Southwest. To join that kind of company seemed far beyond any achievements that I had to my credit, and I took on the assignment with quite a bit of trepidation. But I immediately conceived the project as being a collaborative effort. And I submitted to Bob a statement calling for proposals to collaborate on the series. And Bob pointed out to me that he initially thought that I'd be the editor of each of the volumes, and the Clark series had never done a series based on a collaborative effort. But I learned a great lesson in my career as a country musician, and it was always play with better players. And I was a terrible musician, but I managed to corral excellent, very skilled musicians into the various bands that I played in. And it taught me that you improve your own work and you test your own limits by working with people who are much better than you are. And I'm happy to say that the people up here on the in the front of the room with me are much better scholars than I am and are a wonderful group of people to work with. In addition, we've been joined by scholars including Michael Landon, Ken Owens, Floyd O'Neill, and Greg Thompson's joined us, but Greg won't be speaking today. And finally, David L. Bigler, one of the unappreciated but great historians of Mormonism. And I was very pleased to arrange with David to publish his book, Forgotten Kingdom, The Mormon Theocracy in the American West, 1847 to 1896, which provides an overview of the subject matter that the Kingdom in the West series will deal with. Now, of course, the story of the Mormons in the West is an old story that's had considerable ink expended upon it. But from my perspective, it has been a fairly narrow approach to a subject of national interest. And the view of Mormonism in the West that we hope that the series will illuminate is the connections, the role of the Mormons in a bigger story, the settling and development of the American West. And partly because of the nature of Mormon historiography, it's largely been a Utah project. And it's often been remarkably Utah-centric in that the scholars tend to view larger issues from the perspective of a small state that in the larger national picture is of arguably minor significance. And also, the Mormon contributions in other areas of the West, such as California, other elements of the Great Basin, and even Colorado, have been pretty generally ignored. But one of the roles of this series is to try to incorporate the Mormon contribution to the opening of the West into the larger picture and make the connections and the significance more apparent to scholars outside of the fairly narrow discipline of Mormon history. One delightful feature of the series, I believe, will be its geographical orientation. When people think of Mormon history, they think of Utah. But you'll find as you look at the list that almost half the volumes will not take place in Utah. Most of the action will be taking place, as in the case of the Samuel Brannan papers, in California, in the Mormon Battalion narratives, in the Great Southwest, and the Great Basin. We have what I think will be one of the most innovative pieces of scholarship forthcoming with Mel Johnson's study of Texas trails to Zion's and the body of trail literature that is unexploited, recounting how Texas Mormons came to Zion in wagon parties as early as 1849. It's this broadening of vision, and the second great function of the series, which is to bring to life the Mormon voice in the West. Dale Morgan once talked of the hidden treasures of folk literature that lay untouched in Mormon archives. And one of the great adventures that I've experienced so far is discovering these colorful, significant, and eloquent voices that have for so long been ignored in the greater study of the West. And you will be encountering people like James Ferguson, a Scotch-Irish military man of tremendous eloquence and magnificent handwriting, who first wrote the official history of the Mormon Battalion as its official church-appointed historian, and later was Adjutant General of the Nauvoo Legion in its conflict with the American government. A man like Thomas Bullock, whose voice is finally presented in the context of the 1847 emigration, a man who essentially wrote the volumes that became the history of the church, now at last has his life examined separately from the achievements of Brigham Young, which he zealously documented, but in whose shadow he has remained for more than 150 years. Also, the element of women's voices. On this list, we haven't incorporated several other exciting projects. We've talked to Todd Compton about doing one of the Partridge Sisters journals, and we're hoping to lure Marty Bradley into our web, perhaps with the journals of Hannah Tapfield King or some additional Mormon women's narratives. But there will be surprises throughout the series, and one of the surprises we hope will be the presence of women's voices. And I'd like to point you to a letter from a sister of a Mormon battalion soldier written in August of 1846 that is one of the most moving and eloquent statements of love and faith that I have yet encountered in my years of working with Mormon records. Again, I want to tell you what an honor it has been to take on this assignment, and what a joy it has been to collaborate with the people that you see before you. And we had our first formal get-together last night at the Alta Club, hosted by our friend Mike Homer, and we anticipate that it will be the first of many. And many of our editors are meeting in this room for the first time. And I want to welcome you to the first of the Kingdom in the West Dog and Pony shows, which is what this event is. And remember this because you all have an invitation sometime about 2004 or 2005 to attend the final Kingdom in the West Dog and Pony Show and the party that will follow when we finally have 15 volumes of the documentary record of Mormonism on the shelf. You are all invited to a party because we intend to celebrate the achievement of this difficult but wonderful project. Now, we have no way of determining order and rank in the callings of our editors. I do want to say, however, that David Bigler was unable to attend. David's book was published this spring. I believe, I'm prejudiced, of course, but I believe that Forgotten Kingdom is the most significant history of Mormons in the 19th century West ever written. I believe it will be a model and a template for future examinations of Utah's territorial history. And I have learned so much from working with a man like David Bigler, who's devoted his life to the study of the American West. And I would point to that book as a harbinger of some of the innovations and new interpretations that we hope to bring through with the series. And I'll give brief introductions to each editor as they appear. We're going to go down the list that's in the program. We're going to start with Michael Homer, who has made one of the most intriguing proposals for our forthcoming series. And Mike is an attorney and currently a member of the State Board of History and my recently acquired but very dear friend. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. I have been struck over the last 20 to 25 years that I've been collecting books at the fact that we seem to be aware of what others have said about us in this community, in this state, in this territory, if they've written in English. And, for instance, if you look at Among the Mormons, most of the authors selected for that book were either British or American. There is some information about Jules Remy, but Jules Remy was also published in English the year after his book appeared in French for the first time. Because of that, I started trying to look at the books that had been published, particularly in the 19th century, about Utah and the Mormons, to see if there's any major differences between the observations of the continental Europeans and the British. And I was struck that there are some significant differences because of their political orientations, because of their religious beliefs, and just because of the fact that many of them didn't have a concept for why anyone would leave the European continent to come to Utah. So my proposal, which I'd been toying with for some time and which I ran by Will, is to collect as many of these accounts, limiting myself to France, Italy, and Germany, and to get them translated and then to try to put them into some kind of a format where we can understand more clearly the image of Mormonism and of Utah in Europe. This is particularly of interest to me because I have a great opportunity from time to time to go to Europe and to discuss with the locals their concept and their idea of what the Utah experience is all about. And believe it or not, it really hasn't changed over the last 100 years very much. One vignette is at a recent deposition over there, and I've related this story to several of you in the audience already, so bear with me. Went there, and they said, "Oh, you're from Utah. That's great. You have great national parks. You have incredible scenery. You have the Olympics coming, great skiing. And, boy, that Utah Jazz are incredible." And I'm sort of going, "Oh, this is great," you know, because normally the first thing out of the blocks is Mormonism and polygamy. And so I'm just feeling real good and said, "Boy, you know, the image is out there. It's changing. It's building." And then, of course, the next day in the Paris newspapers, the story of the Rodin exhibit in BYU hit the papers. And of course, so all of that goodwill that was built up that first day just was eliminated immediately. I was actually surprised. I went through Flake initially and tried to pull out as many books as I could see by Germans, Italians, and French. And I was surprised at the number of books that are in there, most of which have never been translated, never been read in English. But I'm even more struck by how many books are out there that are not in Flake. Probably twice as many out there that are not in Flake as are in Flake. And one of my favorite activities in Europe is to go into bookstores and see if I can find something that I haven't found before. And it's each time there's something different. Briefly, let me just tell you what I anticipate the organization of my book will be. I'm going to divide it into three separate time periods. First, start talking about the overland travelers, essentially from the beginning of the territory until 1869 with the coming of the Transcontinental Railroad. The first visitor I'll talk about is a fellow by the name of Leonetto Cipriani, who was actually born and raised and buried in Corsica, but like most Corsicans, has a Tuscan background, and during the Risorgimento actually went to the aid of the Grand Duke and worked for him. Now, he is the one that really keyed me in on this different mentality, because here is an aristocrat, someone who believes in a very strong, non-democratic form of government, and quite liberal in terms of the way he views the personal and religious lives of people. He comes to the U.S., visits Utah in 1853, and his observation is, boy, I like the way this Brigham Young is running this government. No separation of church and state. That's the way it should be, and he's very autocratic. So he is complimentary, whereas many of the British and American travelers during the same period, of course, were criticizing that very same thing. He also says something interesting about polygamy, and I've related this to Carmen. He relates a conversation he had with John Taylor in 1853, and he said, and he quotes John Taylor as saying, you know, polygamy is a good thing, and it's here, and we believe in it, but the brethren understand that at some point in time, when the church gets very large, that we're going to have to do away with polygamy, because it'll be hard to control it in a large institution. That struck me as being something that I had never read before, particularly in light of Brother Taylor's later stance on polygamy. The next time frame will be the rail travelers, who came in from 1869 to roughly, I'm going to take it up to about 1896. And as one would suspect, there's many more of these, because it was easier to get to Utah on the railroad. Many people decided that if they were passing through the territory, it would be an interesting thing to take the rail from Ogden down to Salt Lake and to look at these strange folk running around Salt Lake City. Even though there's a lot more of them, there's not that many who came to Utah during that time frame who actually wrote histories. So the people that did take the time to actually write about their visit to Salt Lake City and other portions of the territory usually kept very good notes and have some extremely interesting observations to make, even quoting from dialogue that they had with the local inhabitants. And finally, post-statehood, up to about 1930. In fact, the last author I think I'll probably use is another Italian by the name of Zopito Valentino. And is it Valentino or Valentini? I forget. Valentini. He's an interesting fellow because he came to Utah in 1930, visited with the Italian-American community, and he writes some things in there that are a little bit counterintuitive. among them being that he talked to the Mormon prophet, and the Mormon prophet was bragging about how many wives he had. Now, I have a hard time believing that Heber J. Grant was doing that in 1930. But perhaps he had different, when he had different audiences, he had different conversations with those audiences. So all in all, I think it'll be interesting to look at these various authors. There's going to be some crossover. I want to share with Bill and Carmen and whoever else in the group if there's things in my travel accounts that they might find interesting in their books. I think it would certainly be interesting to share with them, and we can probably come to some accommodation on how we're going to use the material together. So that's really roughly an outline of the way I will divide it up and look at why they were here, what they wrote about, their observations, and then perhaps come to some conclusions about how their accounts and their observations of the territory may differ a little bit from what we're used to seeing in some of the American and British writers. Thank you.
I actually had the pleasure of meeting our next presenter as I was developing the Bullock narrative. And fortunately for Violet's husband, he has her. And the great success of Stanley Kimball over the years, I think, is in no small part due to the support and the editorial brilliance of his wife. And one of the honors of being in this series is being able to work with a delightful person and scholar like Violet Kimball. She is a mother of four, a grandmother to nine, and a wife to just one, and the only wife to her husband. She has several articles, a BA degree in English, and has worked on a master's degree in history. She helped co-author Voyage of Discovery, The Story of the Mormon Trail. She's ghostwritten several other works. And she has her own book, in their own words, Stories of Young Pioneers, in preparation for the fall of 1999 by Mountain Press. Violet's goal is to be, quote, the Grandma Moses of the literary set. And I think that she will far exceed the beloved Grandma Moses in many of her accomplishments, and she will be one of the most valuable elements in the series, I believe, in bringing to life Daughters of Zion, women's narratives of the Mormon West. Violet Kimball.
In spite of what Will said, I publicly acknowledge that I am not a household word in the literary, scholarly Mormon community. I am your basic journalist, photographer, and I tell people that in our family, Stan is the scholar intellect, I am the so-called. When people saw the names on the panel, I envisioned them as saying, who is Violet Kimball? Well, let me tell you just a little bit. I met Will Bagley back for the first time in Octa about 4 years ago. We chatted a little bit, and he had the book that Stan and I did, and he asked us to autograph it. I thought that was really special. He must have dragged it all the way there from here. So soon he emailed us with the news that author H. Clark wanted to do a series on the Mormon experience with him as the editor. He asked both of us to edit one of the volumes. I told Will, I wasn't all that qualified. And I said, my merits as a Mormon scholar, and they still aren't known, Bill, Will, and I'm not surprised that you are building me up because you've got to sell Violet Kimball here. A few months later, Stan was asked to read the manuscript for Will's award-winning Thomas Bullock manuscript. So, as is my custom, I made some notes in the margins, and I read it, and usually people, I think, just totally ignore me, so what does Violet know? But Will took me seriously, and he actually says he took some of my comments, and I can't even remember now what they were. But the more I insisted to Will that I wasn't the person he needed, the more he assured me I was. So he didn't even know I was using reverse psychology. It worked. Here I am. Anyway, so even though I tried to convince Will why I wouldn't be the best person for the job, I want to convince you why I will be. But even though I have not actually made an outline, because this is a future book, I've certainly gotten a lot of ideas. And so I think I have some good insight, and I'll bring a really different perspective for the following reasons. I've been writing a book actually about Mormon women for a long time. Stan and I wrestled with the social history of the Mormon Trail and got a first draft ready. But in our exploring of the Mormon Trail, Stan, of course, wanted to know where every little rut went, where they crossed the Platte, where they camped, and where the oxen baited, and where the brethren had the prayer circles, and that didn't interest me a bit. I wanted to know who the people were, what they did, how they reacted with others. I wanted to know the social aspect. So we do compliment each other, and Stan usually does what I want. So anyway, I've been over the trail 5 times. My husband has, a powerful statement, which he coined, discovering the power of place and the spirit of locale. That's the only way you can really discover the Mormon Trail, is to get out there. So, I started reading primary trail sources about 20 years ago. I wondered why the original diaries and journals didn't mention events which had become Mormon legends. I discovered some interesting things were ignored or glossed over. What I began reading, the real church history and personal accounts, I became perplexed that in so many that the so-called myths had overshadowed the real majesty of the women's contribution. As I read the personal accounts of Patty Sessions, Eliza R. Snow, Helen Mar Kimball Whitney, and others, I wondered why they didn't mention the famous 9 babies being born in the freezing snow that we insist on to this day. Patty was the midwife. Why didn't she mention it in her diary? She kept a diary. And then when I kept going into the material and I read where how they got to the West and the 3 women along and then coming back, they met the other group. And Brigham Young says, and this is in one of the journals, "I don't know of a soul who does not like the location." And I thought, well, that shows how much he paid attention to what the women said, and I wanted to say, that's not true, Brigham. So, then I thought of a phrase about all of these myths and legends that we just insist on holding on. And then that is this: we hold these myths to be self-evident. Mary Smith might have prophesied she would beat the captain of the 50 to Zion, but it was probably born from 9-year-old Joseph Fielding Smith's version. But the reality is, it occurred with a little help from the Lord and a lot of help from Brother John Lawson from the Valley. John Lawson arrived from the Valley with fresh teams for Sister Mary Smith, the William Thompson diary says. So we want our people to be bigger than life. We tend to add a little or a lot. We want them to always trail clouds of glory. I came to realize that Mormon myths are a many splendored thing. I became fascinated with the daughters of Zion as I read their own accounts. This needs to be stressed, I would say. Why is this never mentioned, I ask myself. I started making a lot of notes. I did this for over 5 years, and I think I was really preparing for this volume well without realizing it. So as I read the original diaries and journals, I discovered, along with John MacFarger, Wallace Stegner, and Lillian Slessel, that men seldom mention women, big surprise. And as Stegner noted about the primary account, the women might as well have been invisible. I love reading those accounts, especially the diary daily records. We have boxes full. When Stan first started working in researching, I resented it. I thought he could spend more at home than getting in dusty libraries and archives. But now I really appreciate all of that. I want to share with you just one incident of how wonderful it is to do original research. When I was reading Patty Sessions' diary about the trek across Iowa, I noticed that she said, in one version that she had, she said one thing, and then we had another version, and I read the two versions. Okay, let me tell you what it said. Also, in her unedited diary, there is some explicit and revealing comments about the agony of polygamy. A relative of Patty sent us a copy, and Stan already had a copy. I consulted both to try to discover more about Jane Mannins James, a black convert. I discovered in one the revealing polygamy material had disappeared, so I was a little skeptical of that one. And then one noted, today I delivered Jane Black of a baby boy. And then the other one noted, today I delivered Black Jane of a baby boy. So just imagine what would have happened to me if I hadn't had both copies. Because you really can see how one word can throw you off and how you need to examine quite a few records. So I did further research and finally decided, of course, which one was correct. And I wanted to know if perhaps that baby boy was the first black baby born in Iowa, and I think it was. When I read the same Jane Mannin James and her children walked to Zion in 1847, I pondered that they could have been the first free black family to cross the plains. And I believe that's true, too. Okay, when I read of all the women who had driven a team into the valley and all the young women, young children who had done likewise, including several young girls, I realized there was a story of women who matched the mountains. My book will not have a political or religious agenda, and as I mentioned, I haven't really analyzed and we haven't firmed up who I'm going to use because some of them have been used to death. And some of them very little. So we still have to determine all of that. But as I said, my book is due in 4 or 5 years, I think. But I want to ferret out the little details that make big impressions and the little known women who made significant contributions. I'm anxious to read new material. I believe with John Dition that the element of discovery takes place not during the writing, but during the research. It is my desire and determination to present these women with all of their pettiness and all of their nobility. So how will my interpretation differ from others? About 10 years ago, I also began interested in the Oregon Trail, and I focused on women and children. I was impressed and delighted to discover how much they contributed. I began to feel for the entire pioneer experience. You know, the Mormons were not the only one that crossed the plains. My interest in women led me to do research on several women who had been on the Western Trails earlier. They rode side saddle. They were pregnant. They slept on the ground. So I learned that women coped better with the hardships of the trail than men. I think my knowledge of the Oregon and California trail experience will help me shed some light on the contrast with and similarities of the experiences of the Gentiles and the Mormon women. I believe that's probably why Will wanted me. I'm sorry. Wanted me in here. So I don't look at the Mormon experience through rose-colored glasses nor through a glass darkly. I want to tell the women's experiences from their perspective. The stories of these women speak to my heart, sister to sister. I've walked in their footsteps from Nauvoo to Utah. I felt their presence along some of the dusty roads. At winter quarters, I walked those paths while humming, "I walk today where Eliza walked. I walk today where Emmeline walked. I walk today where Valette walked." And I thought of them giving blessings, of being blessed. I've camped at Devil's Gate and spent one of the most miserable nights of my life on a very miserable inflated air mattress in the back of a station wagon. I thought the night would never end. But it was the misery that made it special. I could associate with those early women. Imagine the millions of mosquitoes, the dreadful heat or soaking rain, the noise of sheep and restless cattle, the stench of human waste, and the miles of mud and manure. Who else can claim to have seen Devil's Gate by dawn's early light? I loved my night of misery, and I know that sounds like an oxymoron. A British writer said, "Historians don't need more books, they need stronger boots." This is how we capture the power of place, and I hope to impart that to the readers of Daughters of Zion. Thank you.
I believe that one of the hallmarks of Kingdom in the West will be surprises, and I think Violet might provide us with some of our most pleasant surprises. I believe that the current governor of Utah would have done well to read the works of our next scholar, B. Carmen Hardy, because he might then have some dim grasp of the issues surrounding polygamy. Now, of course, we know, many of us who've grown up in Mormon culture, that polygamy is not the central driving concern of the modern church. But to outsiders and in our history, it has been perhaps the single most important issue, and certainly in the image of the wider world, polygamy is what distinguishes Mormonism. But we seldom have revealed the image of polygamy that was current in Utah, and we've often lost the view of how central it was to Mormon belief and practice in the 19th century. In many ways, polygamy and its origins are the wellsprings of the distinctive features of Mormon history and of Mormon theology. And I think few people understand this with greater depth or clarity than Carmen Hardy. Carmen is a now professor emeritus at California State University at Fullerton. His work, Solemn Covenant, is one of the defining works of scholarship on the subject, and when I announced the series and had Carmen respond with a proposal, that was maybe the moment I was convinced that the series was going to work and be a major contribution to scholarship. But I announced that Carmen had submitted a proposal and we'd accepted it on a LDS book discussion group that I participate in, and I received a private message from one of my more respected colleagues who said, you couldn't have found a better scholar to handle the subject. And everything that I have learned since confirms that evaluation. It's my honor to introduce Carmen Hardy. I'm going to have to go out and try to find the governor and take care of some other things for a few minutes. So take good notes, because I want to know everything that's said in the next few minutes.
Actually, I'm going to the bathroom.
Just to the left, rock. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Will. I've been interested in Mormon polygamy for well over 30 years, and in that time, often gathering material and notes of a variety of kinds, I've often thought I would like to write a documentary history of Mormon polygamy, of providing a history of the institution and the practice through the study of primary documents. And so I was delighted to be invited to be a part of this series and this project, and to work with such a distinguished group of fellow editors, and work under the direction of Will Bagley. One of the things that has emerged in my mind again and again with increasing strength as an impression about Mormon polygamy is the thing that Will was just talking about, how extraordinarily important it was to the 19th century church, an importance and a priority that has, I fear, been forgotten, largely as a result of silence concerning it in the 20th century. But one can read few diaries, few journals, few pronouncements by the First Presidency or discourses by apostles and others in the church in the 19th century without discovering again and again that they truly did come to believe, particularly after they arrived in the Great Basin, that celestial marriage, as they most frequently called plurality at that time, was, as they put it, the cornerstone, or as another writer put it, the capstone of the gospel. It summed up, it brought together priesthood, family, government, eternal increase, so many of the principles that the church stood for and was so proud of, all came together with the practice of plural marriage. One writer in the Deseret News in the 1870s said that plurality was the most grand and magnificent unfoldment to come from the lips of the great seer of the 19th century, as they put it. And that sentiment you encounter again and again and again. Not only this, but other themes are items and points of view that I want to emphasize and illuminate through the documents that I hope to gather and present in my particular volume. And while this volume is designed to provide a chronological kind of overview, it will also emphasize and underline a variety of themes and emphases and topics within the subject of polygamy. For example, in the very first section, dealing with the earliest period of the church, in addition to things like the 1843 revelation and the accusations of the church, in addition to documents like that, I want to include something like the 1831 revelation on marrying Indians, which may well have been the first real formal introduction and attention to polygamy. Because if we are to believe W.W. Phelps, who provides us with a copy of that revelation, which I read in his handwriting in the church archives just 2 days ago, it was indeed intended to be accomplished, that is to say, the marrying of Indian wives, through that same practice that was participated in by the ancient patriarchs, namely polygamy. It's an interesting revelation as well, because Phelps says that Joseph Smith hoped that by that means they would also be able to lighten the skins and the complexions of the Indians by marrying into them, which is interesting because it suggests that Joseph Smith not only intended to reintroduce and restore the practice of patriarchal marriage after the manner of the ancients, but that he had a eugenic object. That is to say that there was a purpose here of a social and a biological kind to be associated with polygamy, something, of course, that would be emphasized and picked up again later when they arrive in the Great Basin. I want to include a document like the dream of Joseph Holbrook, a diary that I think has never been published. Holbrook struggled tremendously with the revelation on plural marriage in the 1840s, and tells how one day he was contemplating the subject while he was out harvesting in the field. This is about 1844-45. I think it was after the assassination of Joseph Smith. And he said suddenly he had this dream, this vision, where he could see planets orbiting about suns, going to eternity, systems within systems, and how all of these magnificent, all this magnificent space was to be peopled and could be peopled only as a result of institutions like polygamy. Well, the point is that in addition to emphasizing or trying to restore the practice for purposes of imitating the ancients or to simply follow the directions of the prophet and his revelation, that early, even before they had gone west, they had given the institution and the practice of polygamy a cosmological dimension and image. After the settlement in the Great Basin, and particularly after the public announcement of polygamy in the early 1850s, the church begins to mill out publications, pamphlets, preaching, writing of all kinds on plural marriage in an extraordinary volume. I made the statement the other night in visiting with some of my colleagues here that I think it may be that we encounter in the 1850s and 60s in Mormon writing and literature the greatest volume of apologetic literature ever produced in behalf of polygamous life. Michael suggested that I might be a little careful, that I might not be correct on that. But in any case, it was an enormous volume and river of writing, most of it forgotten and ignored since that time. And one of the things about these writings and these publications at this time, where the church was so bold and so vigorous, was its very hostile attack on monogamy, and how that this was an expression of corruption, an invention of an apostate church, and that only through the recognition of plurality of wives would a happy and successful society ever be established again. In addition to that, again and again and again, you encounter in these articles, which would come out in series, it wasn't just one now and then, but the Deseret News in issue after issue after issue was setting forth these kinds of positions, that it would be through plurality and through the institution of plural marriage that men and women would be physiologically transformed, that we would live longer, we would come to regain the longevity of the ancients, happier, bigger. There's one magnificent piece in the Deseret News where they said, how can you possibly deny the truthfulness of what we're saying when you can see every day on the streets of Salt Lake City boys weighing 200 pounds where their parents only weigh about 150? There's no question that this is working. Well, I'm very anxious to get into that particular section of the book because this stuff is so colorful and so wonderful, but so sincerely set forth. They truly believed that they were going to revolutionize the world and that they had the technique by which it would be accomplished. I also want to provide a section in the book that deals to some degree with observations made of the practice of polygamy by foreigners and outsiders and non-Mormons, and Michael has some documents that I think will be very helpful to me in that regard. And I want to give attention to the women and their point of view. They, after all, constituted a majority of those involved in the polygamous practice. We often forget that. There were far more women than men, by definition, involved in the arrangement. And a number of them had some very, very interesting things to say, both positive and negative. Like the very moving account of Mary Tracy Elizabeth Allred, who tells of 2 years living with a fellow wife and their common husband and their children together in a tent. It's a magnificent narrative. Or that wonderful interview between Jane Snyder Richards and Hubert Howe Bancroft that was conducted and is in the Bancroft Library, and I'm hoping that they'll give permission to include that as well. Obviously, some attention is going to have to be given in the book to the anti-polygamy crusade that really began to warm up in the 1870s and especially in the 80s. But in addition to the usual kinds of documents, the court cases and the anti-polygamy legislation that was passed, which must be represented in the book, I hope to give evidence that it was really in the 1880s that the most crucial changes occurred. My conviction is that it was not 1890 with the manifesto where the axial moment in Mormon history occurred, where they began to merge with the mainstream of American society. But it was in the 1880s. It was before the manifesto, which really comes along as a kind of a conclusion to what was already underway. It is in the 1880s, as I hope to demonstrate with appropriate documents, that they began to use the term celestial marriage as meaning both monogamous as well as polygamous marriage. Whereas prior to that time, it was always used only to refer to plurality. My time's up.
Time's up.
Okay.
Wrap it up.
All right. I'll make one last comment, and that is that George Q. Cannon at one point said that if all of the principles associated with plural marriage were properly implemented and put into practice, this entire Utah and Salt Lake Valley would be filled with a population of men and women who would have the complexion of angels and who would live to reach the age of the ancient patriarchs. It is that noble, very bold and wonderful and colorful experiment and effort that I want to document in this particular volume.
I'm not turning into a very good time enforcer because I'm enjoying this too much, and I don't want to cut off these wonderful presentations. Again, to return to the theme of surprise, which I think one of our later speakers will expand upon, I last year made contact with a friend that I'd known in high school, and we were both veterans of seminary class in the Oceanside Carlsbad ward. I wanted to ask Mel, did you graduate from seminary? Well, I did. So I could pull rank on Mel in this one field. And I wanted to note that the rigors of seminary in California quite outstrip the coddling that is given to Utah seminary students. And that getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to attend a seminary class before school begins at 7:30 is an arduous and difficult task, in addition to being often as boring as I assume Utah seminary classes are. But so Mel and I go back a long time. We hadn't spoken for more than 30 years, but we had both pursued a interest in Mormon history and had devoted much of our waking hours to the study of these items. And somehow, how a good Mormon Californian wound up in Texas is beyond me, but maybe Mel can explain that. But he settled in Texas and his interest was in milling and mechanical operations on the Texas frontier. And what he continually ran into were references to Mormons involved in these operations. That led him to explore the Mormon presence in Texas, which is something that certainly Utah scholars have pretty effectively ignored over the years. But it is an amazing part of the story of the Lone Star State. And the interactions between Mormons and Texas in the 1850s is a fascinating and untold story. And I'll let Mel Johnson fill you in a little bit more on some of the fascinating details of the project that we're undertaking, tentatively titled Mormon Trails to Zion, Texas Narratives of the Cherokee Trail.
As a teenager and a young adult, Will may have spent most of his waking hours studying Mormon history. I spent most of mine in observation and chasing of the opposite gender. I want to clear that. One of the great opportunities of what we're doing here is that hopefully when this series is done, that no one will be able to look at Western Americana again, without understanding the Mormon presence in it. And secondly, none can look at Mormona without understanding the presence of Western Americana in that. This is an interlinked study. Until this week, most of us were strangers, hopefully friends now. But Professor Hardy does not know that I grew up as a boy in Fullerton, California, and chased Steve Busby and my other friends through the Orange Groves, where Cal State Fullerton is now. Mike doesn't know that I have a definite interest in his work because one of my pet interests of the Lyman White era in the Central Hill Country of Texas is inadequate because I cannot get many original source Texas German narratives of that period. And I know they exist in Germany. I am California born and bred. I am Texas matured. I am Utah raised and leavened. I am a stranger in a strange land, but yet I feel that I've come home. Why is this important to me? Because there are Texas voices from Mormon dust that have never really been explored before that are important to you and me because it reveals who we are and where we came from. The first active Mormon temple west of the Mississippi was not St. George or even the Endowment House. It was a small two-story lumber temple built on the bank of the Pedernales by Lyman White, where the endowment ceremony was practiced, where ordinances with eternal priesthood consequences were performed, and where a Mormon folk spent 13 years on the frontier, being those things that are definitely Mormon of that time. They were separatist. They were temple. They were common stock. They practiced a theodemocracy. They dominated county politics wherever they went in order to practice what they wanted without interference. And unlike other Mormons of that time and generation through the American West, they got along real well with the Anglo-Celtic neighbors. They chased Comanche. They were chased by Comanche. And then they proceeded to influence the rest of Mormonia. The grandson and great-grandson of Lyman White dominated our LDS historiography for nearly 50 years in the reorganized church. There were Texans that helped settle the Pine Valley Mission and rode with John D. Lee at Mountain Meadows. There were Texans from this group that opened the Cache Valley with Preston Thomas and others. Nearly 1,000 Texans were converted to Utah Mormonism and crossed the Cherokee Trail for almost a dozen years and had tremendous influence in the church in terms of race, in terms of its approach to women and the place in the home. There is a southern aspect to Mormonism that has never really been explored, that truly should be. These are Texas voices from Mormon dust that want to be heard, that are speaking out, and we're going to do that. I see the work primarily falling into three areas. The first will be the Lyman White expedition to Texas. 3rd June 1844, John Walton, not our John Boy of television fame, but a land speculator living in Galveston, writes a letter to Joseph Smith. He says, "Joseph, you need to bring your people to Texas. You'll have the votes. You'll dominate it. You can be the king of Texas if you want. Not only that, you can go conquer Mexico, plunder the territory, and subject the people to your needs." Now, the thing is, we don't know if Joseph ever read the letter or not. But the Council of 50 had been, of course, looking for places for the saints to go to. Texas was one of those areas. Lyman White and Bishop George Miller were called to go, and they took their small community, probably never more than 250 people at any time. They made one of the greatest epic journeys of the western borderlands, 1,400 miles in 14 months to Austin, a frontier community of about 700 people, and when this 150 people showed up, they were concerned. "Please don't torch the village and take our women. We're going to drive them away." Well, these were fairly good people, the Whiteites, and they had something that the Texans truly came to appreciate. They had a mechanical mill. They could grind cornmeal for the first time on the frontier, made furniture, made lumber, built houses, built a jail, built the first Texas Capitol on the hill in Austin, went west to Fredericksburg, near Fredericksburg in Gillespie County, on the banks of the Pedernales, built a community, dominated the politics, dominated the economy. The floods came and they moved again, and they went to Hamilton Valley, and then Marble Falls, and then Bandera, and then Lyman died on his final journey when he wanted to go back to Missouri. The second part will be the Utah missionary effort to Texas. 1,000 people would leave Texas for Utah because of it. Preston Thomas spent 6 of his missions there. Homer Duncan argued with people in Panola County over the great sin of polygamy, and Homer would say, "If it's such a great sin, then why are there white, blue-eyed children in the Negro quarters?" And every Mormon missionary got chased out of Panola County that night. The third part is a part that truly speaks to the heart. As these people of a different time move either into Iowa to join the Josephites or to the Northwest to join the Utah Mormons, and they do that great passage called the Cherokee Trail, and as the good sister spoke just a little while ago, about just how difficult it was. And then, of course, when the cholera came to the camps, and you buried your child, and you buried your wife, buried your son and your friends, and you never forgot about it for your entire life because you referred to it time and time and time again in your diaries and your journals. Texas Voices for Mormon Dust. Special time. Special place, and I'm honored that Will has a place for me in this.
As I was looking at some of the sources that Mel pointed me to, I found one especially interesting because I was trying to figure out how the Fancher Party got to Utah, and I'd seen a note in the Alta California that people traveling the Cherokee Trail on the old Arkansas route had been diverted in 1856 and had gone essentially from where Rawlins is today on the Cherokee Trail up to the Sweetwater River and then taken South Pass across the Rocky Mountains. And that seemed to me to solve many of the routing problems. So I decided, well, I'll look at Preston Thomas's journal, which is an 1857 Texas journal, and he might explain to me what the trail conditions are like and why they would have detoured from the Cherokee Trail to make a crossing up to the Oregon Trail. And what I found was not a surprising event in Mormon journals of 1857, but Thomas, who is later the source of the name for Preston, Idaho, keeps a detailed daily journal up until he reaches the Red River, and then all the remaining pages in the journal have been ripped out. And the son who edited it noted that he had no explanation for why Preston Thomas's trail journal would have been severely edited in its source. And so he replaced it with a patriarchal blessing that was given to Thomas in southern Utah in August of 1857. And in the patriarchal blessing, Thomas has said that he will be one of those who helps forge the Lamanites into the battle axe of the Lord. And this, of course, brings us to the intriguing episode known in Utah's history as the Utah Expedition, or more locally, the Echo Canyon War, or as a recent TV history piece called it, the Mormon Rebellion. And I do not believe there is a more perplexing or less understood event in the history of territorial Utah than the nature, the sources, the course, and the resolution of that critical conflict, which I believe is the most significant conflict between religion and government in the history of the American nation. But my dear friend Bill McKinnon has been on this trail since he, under the direction of Howard Lamar at Yale University, undertook a senior thesis on the Utah Expedition. And Dr. Lamar pointed his honors student at the sources in the Beinecke Library of this little understood and seldom studied conflict. And Bill began looking at them just about the time that Furness's classic study of the Utah Expedition came out. And he's pursued that subject ever since and has established himself as probably the premier leading scholar on the subject. He met Dick Paul in the early 1990s after Dr. Paul retired, and they discussed the collaboration, but unfortunately they were only getting into the initial stages of the project when Dr. Paul died abruptly. And we did have the pleasure Thursday of spending time at Special Collections at the University of Utah examining Dr. Paul's papers, and it's as if he had left us a trail and now all we had to do was follow it to find some of the key sources and evidences of the mystery that we've pursued for so long. But I must say that in my wildest fantasies, I never thought I would be in a situation where I had a former vice president of General Motors working for me. And of course, it's much less cut and dried than that. This is a collaboration, and Bill McKinnon and I are colleagues. But Bill has pursued a distinguished career in business. He now runs a consulting business in Michigan, and he is widely known and widely respected for his knowledge of Utah history and his support of the public history effort in Utah. It's my pleasure to introduce William P. McKinnon, editor of our forthcoming At Swords Point, A Documentary History of the Utah Expedition.
Thanks very much, Will. I want to add to Will's introduction by stating that I am not now, nor have I ever been, Violet Kimball. However, after listening to her, I think it's worth thinking about, and I want to start, as she did, by raising the question of who am I, in a sense. Will has taken a stab at it, and I think I'm going to start by taking a stab at it, too, because it's a little bit of a dichotomy as to how a management consultant born in upstate New York, east of Palmyra, that is, by the way, and not too far from Grandma Moses' Eagle Bridge, how such a person who served in the 20th century United States Air Force comes to be writing a documentary history of the Utah War with its emphasis on the 19th century West, the LDS Nauvoo Legion, and my rival service, the United States Army, of a different period. As Will indicates, for me it all began in the mid-1950s at Yale, where I was as an undergraduate with my twin brother, which sometimes confused Howard Lamar. And at that particular institution, history's taught more by the examination of documents than the reading of textbooks. There's a huge trove of documents on the American West, including Utah there. And under Howard's influence for my senior essay topic, I picked what I then called the edition, but for reasons I'll expand on, I'm now calling the Utah War. And one of the first things I read on the subject wasn't a primary source document. It was Dick Paul's article on how the polygamy issue entered the presidential campaign in 1856, and it was a delight to then first meet him decades later. I continued on after I left college, doing archival research for the subsequent 40 years, have published three articles in the Utah Historical Quarterly on the subject, and then a joint article with Dick, which I finished up after his death, which appeared in the Journal of Mormon History, on the causes of the Utah War. So why might it make sense for me to take this further into a volume for the Kingdom in the West series? I suppose there's the matter of that continuity, objectivity in coming from a different part of the country, a background that understands complex organizations, having spent 25 years working at the top of one almost as complex as the LDS Church and the United States government, including its army. And now you might ask, why am I doing this? Why would I take this on? It's always struck me from the beginning of how little understood the Utah War has been. In the East and in the Midwest, when I talk to people about history and this subject comes up, there's usually a pause, and the person invariably says, how come I never read about that in any of the books I've read? Why wasn't I taught about this in school? And I've noticed it even here. I mean, in Utah, for example, there are a lot of references to Johnston's army, but when you press people about their interest in it, I find most people are totally unaware of who Albert Sidney Johnston was, other than during this two-year window of 1857-58, totally unaware that he was the Confederacy's leading general officer in reputation far beyond that of Robert E. Lee until his death, bleeding to death from an untended leg wound at Shiloh when he was fighting U.S. Grant in his first major engagement. Albert Sidney Johnston had commanded a two-brigade expeditionary force at Fort Bridger at a time when Robert E. Lee was experiencing his first command of line troops in Texas. Lee was Johnston's deputy, his executive officer, in the 2nd Cavalry in Texas, never commanded line troops in the United States Army until 1855, was a captain in the United States Army in 1855, and that was Lee, and that was Johnston. So those are my reasons for wanting to take this on. It's been a fascinating topic for me for 40 years. It's neglected. I think it deserves attention. And in 1996, when I read Bob Clark's prospectus for the Kingdom in the West series and saw that he planned on doing a documentary history on the subject, I called him up and asked if he wanted an editor, and he referred me to Will Bagley. It's a familiar story several of us discovered last night. I mean, a call to Bob Clark in Spokane, a forward to Will Bagley in Salt Lake City, and it all starts from there. And I had not met Will at that time, although he and I both appeared as talking heads in a video called Top of the Mountains, which ran in Salt Lake in January of 1996 for the centennial of statehood. And so it's been a pleasure getting to meet him and working on on this book. What is the concept of the book at Swords Point? What's the concept for a documentary history of the Utah War? And I'm just going to read a little bit from what I sent Bob and Will back in 1996 because it's still true. The concept of the book is that within the context of the Kingdom and the West series, this proposed volume is going to aim to be recognized as the definitive edited compilation of documents setting forth the origins, prosecution, and significance of the conflict in Utah Territory between the LDS Church, that is, its leaders and its members, and the U.S. government, known variously as the Utah War of 1857-58, the Utah Expedition, Johnson's Army, Buchanan's Blunder, the Echo Canyon War, the Mormon Rebellion, and on it goes. Although there would be some overlap in the documents to be included in this book with those in the Hafen's fine 1958 edition, such duplication is going to be minimal, and the proposed volume would go far beyond the Hafen's edition of 1958 and would reflect not only subsequently discovered texts, but the analytical scholarship developed during the 40 years since then, at that point that the Clark Company published Leroy Hafen's book. The editors, that is my approach and style in the selection and presentation of documents, as well as in the development of editorial comments, will be grounded in a pursuit of completeness, fairness, and even-handedness. The objective would be to produce a volume which, taken together with Norman Furness's 1960 narrative study, The Mormon Conflict, or its successor, would be viewed as the most useful authoritative two-volume study account of the Utah War. And a likely byproduct of the proposed volume's extensive footnotes would be the most complete bibliography of sources bearing on the Utah War published to date. Who would be the target market for this volume? As I see it, it's going to be a combination of academic historians of the American West, bibliophiles already collecting earlier publications of the Clark Company, serious non-academic students of the region's history, and members of the LDS Church anxious to learn more about the early travails of their church and Utah's territorial period. In terms of the documents that are going to be included in the book, they're going to be drawn from libraries, archives, historical societies, and private collections. They'd include such traditional primary sources as military orders and correspondence, congressional documents, testimony, executive orders, diaries, personal letters, contemporary newspaper editorials and dispatches, in the text of addresses and sermons, but it would also include extract from other eclectic non-traditional sources which bear on the Utah War, such as poems and Mormon hymns. Excerpts from selected memoirs and articles previously published but largely unavailable to today's scholars would be used in kind of small quantity.
Surprising.
Yes. Okay. The methodology is going to involve picking a lot of people's brains, including many here, and there are also going to be a large number of surprises for you, I think, and for me. There have been along the way. I'll just mention a couple of them. Will reminds me to ask a couple of questions like, were you aware that there was a United States Marine Corps detachment involved in the Army of Utah's efforts at Fort Bridger? Were you aware of the role of Bernard E. B.'s Volunteer Infantry Battalion that was formed at Fort Bridger? B., as you recall, was the man who died at First Manassas after giving Stonewall Jackson his nickname. I think the role, in terms of size and the quality and experience of the Nauvoo Legion, will be a surprise. It wasn't quite the huge monolithic juggernaut that you would think. The non-uniform character of the Mormon pullback from San Bernardino, Carson Valley, Fort Limhi, the United Kingdom, San Francisco, all of those places were done in different ways at different times for different reasons rather than being a pullback executed simultaneously in one fell swoop. The extent of Brigham Young's war preparations months before Pioneer Day on July 24, 1857 was for me a surprise. The gunpowder and munitions and other diplomatic moves that he was making months before the official kickoff of this campaign will be a surprise. The impact on Utah's borders after 1858, how Utah territory shrank from a body with counties 600 miles wide to what it is today in five bites during the 1860s as a partial result of this campaign, a surprise. And for me, one of the biggest surprises was that Brigham Young, the ultimate commander of the Territorial Legion in 1858, 13 years later sent his beloved son Willard to where for care, attention, and professional learning, the United States Military Academy at West Point. Not only did Willard Young go to West Point, his son went to West Point, his grandson went to West Point, and his great-grandson went to Vietnam with the United States Army. Four generations of unbroken involvement in the United States Army from Brigham Young's son Willard, including three consecutive generations at West Point. And then finally, Will, I'll mention that one of the surprises for me has been the residual impact on this campaign years ago in 1857-58. Do you remember what welled up out of southern Utah when Bill Clinton created the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which he announced not in Utah but in the state of Arizona, for at least two reasons I can think of? What welled up in southern Utah in 1996 was the comment, "Darned, it's Johnston's army all over again." So I will forge on with this merry band of editors and authors, and I'm delighted to be here with them and with you today. Thank you. I'm now reverting to my Violet Kimball thing.
One of the pleasures of launching this enterprise has been meeting new people. But one of my oldest and dearest friends immediately sprang to mind as one of our series editors. Linda Carter has been working on researching the Mormon handcart experiment for years. She has a forthcoming narrative history in the works for the University of Utah. And close on its heels, we will be assembling the core documents, the sources of this story. Linda has been for years a Utah school teacher. She has an enviable record of service in the public schools, and she's been an active participant in Utah history circles for much more than a decade. She also now is a mainstay of the Utah Historical Society's Beehive magazine and a wonderful and inspiring friend and colleague. I believe that there are few stories that equal the story of the handcart experiment in terms of basic human drama. But there are also few episodes in Overland or Utah history that are as poorly understood as the whole scope of the event. So I'll let my good friend Linda Carter introduce you to some of the wonders forthcoming.
I'm honored and awed and absolutely overwhelmed to be counted among these great scholars that are working on this series together. If I felt like a nobody before, I certainly have that feeling and belief confirmed this morning as I hear these great people. But I'm very comfortable with the role of nobody, and so I will continue from there. I also feel that Will was very wise. I can understand him putting me last on the program because he was undoubtedly hoping we'd run out of time.
I didn't set the program. I had nothing to do with it.
Few stories in LDS history and are more loved but less understood than the story of the handcart migration. The handcart craze is rampant these days, but factual information is definitely lacking. The vogue, to me, is at times very distressing. It seems everyone is enamored with the Willie and Martin companies because of the disaster, but few know or hear much about the eight other companies who crossed the plains by handcart without being rescued from the snow. The handcart saga, though unique and certainly worth examination, has become so large that the rest of the Mormon migration is being unfairly eclipsed. Although much has been written about the handcart journey, little of it has been from a balanced point of view. Sensational anti-Mormon articles or materials written for the purpose of testimony building or to honor the pioneers have for years dominated, with neither telling the complete story. Leroy and Ann Hafen's Handcart's Design is an exception and is to be commended. However, many documents have come to light since their work nearly 40 years ago, and it is time to make this additional information available. For these reasons, it is apparent there is a need for a new, balanced, updated, objective, scholarly, thorough, and accurate history of the Mormon handcart experiment and the people who traveled this unique way. By writing the handcart volume for the Kingdom in the West series, I will endeavor to meet that challenge and try to fill the need. According to Will and all the promotional materials, the title of my work was to be Tongue Nor Pen Can Never Tell the Sorrow, a documentary history of the Mormon handcart experience. But I'll let you in on a little secret. That's not going to be my title. In fact, I found out this morning that already that is not my title, because on the new materials, Will has put on that the title is A Hard Way to Please the Lord. And you have to be careful what you say around Will in a, you know, casual conversation, because I happened to mention that to him a couple of weeks ago, saying that I was considering that, and now all of a sudden it is my title. So I'm still working on a title. It hasn't come to me yet. But I really felt that the title, Tongue Nor Pen Can Tell, was too narrow. It narrowed my focus and the reader's focus onto the Martin and Willie companies and their emotion-charged story of hardship and death and drama and the drama of the rescue. However, this is only a part of the true handcart story. It cannot be allowed to dominate or overshadow the entire system. The disaster showed that the agents who implemented the program were not infallible. And although I do not personally see the handcart plan as eminently successful, as it has been lauded in the past, it was an economic expedient that accomplished what it set out to do, and that was to give large numbers of the economically deprived the opportunity to immigrate to Zion. In that, it did succeed. What these immigrants could not pay for out of their pockets, they could earn with their muscle and sweat and determination. All 10 handcart companies, 3,000 people from 1856 through 1860 paid the price to get to Zion the hard way. And although most did not pay with their lives, all deserve recognition. Their story is an integral and unique component of the history of the American West, as well as the history of the LDS Church, a fact that is often overlooked. Even though it should not and cannot be ignored, the subject must be kept in perspective. Only about 4% of the Mormons who crossed the plains pulled handcarts. That's only approximately 3,000 out of the 70,000 immigrants. Though wagon trains crossed the plains to Utah for 22 years, handcarts were used during only four of those years, 1856, 57, 59, and 60, with two-thirds coming during the first year of the experiment. With the exception of that year, covered wagons were still by far the preferred form of transportation. But because the handcart represents desire